Much of the cultural portrayal of historic Route 66 evokes an image of white middle-class America with an emphasis on white. But there's a more tragic side of Route 66. Author Candace Taylor has written a book called Overground Railroad about Route 66 Green Book sites, places that were safe for African Americans to see, eat, and stay during the decades of Jim Crow and racial segregation. In advance of the Route 66 conference in Normal tomorrow through Sunday, Taylor spoke with WGLT student reporter Darnisha Mitchell about her book. Taylor says the book idea began when she had a commission to write a travel guide and an earlier book on counterculture. Taylor says she found most books on Route 66 were written by white males, and she is a black woman.
It was striking to me that there was this agency around, you know, we want to celebrate this nostalgia factor of the middle class white nuclear family jumping into their Airstream trailers in the 1950s. And I thought, well, what did the black folks do? And, you know, because I'd never seen any black imagery or anything of other cultures on Route 66, especially that were celebrating this 1950s era nostalgia. And once I started asking that question is how I found the Green Book. I saw my first copy at the Autry Museum in Los Angeles, and I had never seen such a thing. I never knew such a thing existed. And I ran out and called my parents and asked them, you know, do you know about this? And my mother didn't know, but my stepfather, he grew up in Tennessee in the Jim Crow South, and he had remembered the Green Book.
You've cataloged 9,600 Green Book listings, scattered over 3,600 Green Book sites and 160 Green Book properties in 48 states. And you also said you found one third of these sites to still be standing and less than 5% are still in operation. Talk a little bit more about what you observed when you visited these properties.
Well, it's been a journey. You know, I've taken many trips. And as you said, I mean, right now I'm up to over 9,700 sites that I've cataloged and about 4,000 that I've actually visited. And it's striking to me. I mean, I've mapped all of these as well. And so when I look at my maps, I can see that they are clustered. Most of these Green Book sites, about 80%, are clustered in traditional black neighborhoods, whether it's Harlem or Bronzeville or South Central in Los Angeles. And within those clusters, you find this vibrant, especially during the time that they were listed in the Green Book, was during the second wave of the Great Migration. So there were these vibrant communities opening up in these cities because a lot of black folks were moving from the South into Philadelphia and Detroit and whatever. So these were places that were historically black, had been black for several decades, 50, 60, 70, 80 years. And so when I went to those areas today, it was again very striking and intense, because in some cases, you know, there's areas obviously of South Central where the Dunbar is a Green Book site. It's tree-lined streets. There's kids playing. It's not the scary South Central that we've been told, you know, or that maybe in the 80s when there were a lot of shootings. It's not that South Central today. So there were some areas that were refreshingly and pleasant. And then there were others that were extremely dangerous and sad. And I saw a level of poverty most Americans, I don't think, even know exist in this country. And violence, which we hear about on the news, but being in a place like Chicago on the South Side, where 23 people have been shot that weekend, the weekend I was there in the neighborhood that I was in, because I've been to Chicago many, many, many times. It's a beautiful city. It's one of my favorite cities. But the majority of the violence happens in these very small clusters, and that happened to be the area where these Green Book sites were. And so places like that, Detroit, Miami, I had to leave Miami early because I did not feel safe. I've been lunged at and, I haven't been physically assaulted. There have been attempts of people chasing me. So it's a very... it was an intense process, and I'm still doing the scouting because I've only scouted about 4,000 sites, just less than half of what I'm going to do. So I travel with a stun gun, with mace and a knife, but I do think it's important to go to some of these communities and see how some of these places have retained their dignity despite, all of the problems that have happened with their financial issues and mass incarceration. There's so many factors, there's so many government factors that have contributed to this state that these communities are in. So I don't want to badmouth Detroit or Chicago. I don't think it's the people in the community, I don't think it's their fault that the situation is what it is. But it was very surprising to me to see how extreme it was.
What do you think prompted the change in the culture, the flare in violence?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Green Book ceased publication in 1967. That was the last year the Green Book was published. And right after that, which is ironic, is when Nixon's Law and Order initiative started to take place. And from then, every president, Democrat or Republican, it's not a partisan issue, has consistently had this, idea we're going to get tough on crime. And as much as, and even the Clinton crime bill, which I'm sure most people are hearing more and more about, was one of the toughest initiatives that has done irreparable damage to these communities. And so now you fast forward to the present, and you see that literally there are these things called million-dollar blocks. And Chicago's, there was a study out of Columbia University and a local historian who was doing work on million-dollar blocks that are in Chicago. And what that is that really they've estimated that close to 80% of the community has been locked up or is under some kind of correctional control. And within that community, I mean, there's buildings that are just boarded up because people just are literally been kind of rehoused into prisons. And what they're saying is, well, I mean, it's costing millions of dollars per block to imprison these people. And so what would happen if we spent millions of dollars and funneled that into resources for education and support and not imprisoning them? So, that's what I've found since the Green Book sites were still alive after, obviously, the Green Book ceased publication. But there was also urban renewal that was a big factor where the government literally came in by eminent domain and took out these businesses and put freeways in. And so when I was scouting, I would find sometimes just 20 businesses that may be on a, in a 3 or 4 block radius that were just, it was a freeway now. And so that really decimated the community as well. So you have, heavy policing, mass incarceration, you have urban renewal, and now we have gentrification, which is the kind of threat. And it was surprising. I mean, some of the roughest neighborhoods in St. Louis, where Green Book site was, I did an interview of Loper's Tire Service, and his family had run that tire business when he was a child, and Don Loper is still running it today. He said this wasn't like this, but now it's just creeping blocks away from him that whites are moving in and buying up all these old properties. And so he's grandfathered in, like he can keep his business because he's been there so long. But that's another threat that has taken over these communities as gentrification.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Darnisha Mitchell. We're talking with Kendacy Taylor, the author of Overground Railroad. It chronicles the Black experience of Route 66. With what you've mentioned about gentrification, do you hope the book will prompt more conversation about gentrification?
Yeah, I mean, the point of my book isn't just to write about, it wasn't just to focus on this historic travel guide and kind of, in the historic time capsule of what it could be, because it's very easy to just relegate the Green Book to saying, oh God, thank God, that was in the past. And some people think we need a new Green Book, So I felt like it was important after being in these communities, it was my mission to make sure that people would look at the Green Book through the lens of today. Because all these layers of history and how these communities thrived and then suffered and then thrived again, or all that pendulum of justice that swings back and forth. The book really takes the reader through all of those, each decade, of where we made strides in terms of racial progress and where we fell back, and how these Green Book sites and Black travelers facilitated or endured or survived or triumphed despite all of these things like redlining. And I think it's important to show that, yes, and now gentrification is another hurdle that we never really get. It's not that progress has ever been in a straight line, right? That things just have progressively gotten better. That is not how our history works. It's never been the way that it works. I think it's a belief system that we want to believe in America, that things are just progressively getting better, but that's not how it works. Things get better and then they get worse, and then they get better and then they get worse. So I think this idea that we can kind of rest on our laurels as having this united country where everybody's equal, I think we have a lot of political challenges now that are kind of shining spotlight on our belief system and the reality of what's happening. So I, you know, it was important for my book to have that discussion, to show how something so simple like a Black Traveler's Guide could provide access and power to so many people. And so it's a story not just about struggle, but also about triumph and resilience and all of the things that Black people have had to do, but not just survive, but to thrive in spite of it. And so, you know, it's a balancing act. There's some sad stories, but there's also uplifting stories about, you know, where we are and what we're capable of as a race.
So what was it like for African Americans traveling through Route 66?
It was fascinating to me to learn, you know, that half of the counties along Route 66 were sundown towns. And so that was striking and kind of incomprehensible how they did it, because there was no Twitter, there wasn't even a sundown town map. And sundown towns were all white communities that banned Black folks after 6 p.m. So it was baffling to me to think how prepared you would have to be as a Black family to travel Route 66, especially during, you know, from the late 30s to the 60s when the Green Book was published. How, you know, they were as prepared as you could be. There was no way you would know that, you know, there were over 200 sundown towns in the state of Missouri. And so if you happened to leave St. Louis at the wrong time, how could you get through this, you know, state if you needed anything? And most of the white-owned businesses didn't serve Black folks. So, you know, that was and there weren't as many Green Book sites as one would hope on that stretch.
WGLT student reporter Dinesha Mitchell talked with cultural historian Candace Taylor, the author of Overground Railroad, The Green Book and Roots of Black Travel in America. That comes out in January. Taylor speaks at the Miles of Possibility Conference on Route 66 Friday evening at the ISU Alumni Center. She says it's important to her to have the information accessible in more than book form. Her next big project is an exhibition developed from the book with the Smithsonian. That opens in June in the National Civil Rights Museum in Tennessee and will travel the nation over several years. There's also a board game and a mobile app to help learn the history of African Americans on Route 66 as you walk the streets or drive the country.